Russia pressing for control over Ukraine's southeastern Donbas region after taking full control of the port city of Mariupol. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison concedes defeat in national elections that end a decade of conservative rule. And Palestinian mourners take part in the funeral of a 17-year-old boy who was shot dead by Israeli forces earlier today. Hello, welcome. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Russia has just cut off flow of natural gas to Finland after it refused to pay for future supplies in the Russian national currency. Finland's energy firm says, although regrettable, the halt will cause no disruptions in the gas transmission network. Gasum says that it has been carefully preparing for the situation. Last Saturday, Russia also cut electricity deliveries to Finland over payment issues. The developments come as Finland and Sweden are planning to join NATO. The two submitted their bids on Wednesday. Russia is opposed to their move, citing security threats caused by NATO expansion. Moscow has promised retaliation should Finland and Sweden join the Western military alliance. As the war in Ukraine continues, the West is taking measures spearheaded by the United States that would add more fuel to the burning flames. That is particularly concerning given the devastating toll the conflict is taking on the global economy. This begs the question, are we looking at a prolonged war in Europe, and if so, what would it mean for the rest of the world?
On Thursday, leaders of Sweden and Finland, two European nations that opted for neutrality for years, flanked U.S. President Joe Biden while he threw his support behind their bid to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, at the White House.
And today I'm proud to assure them that they have the full, total, complete backing of the United States of America. Today, my administration is submitting to the United States Congress reports on NATO accession for both countries so the Senate can efficiently and quickly move on advising and consenting to the treaty.
I don't think those nations really ought to be scared of Russia. That would be really stupid if they were. Maybe they are that foolish and believe the narrative going on. I think it's more there's a power play. I mean, you look at the sanctions, that's where you really see the intent. And President Biden said this in Poland. He said, we intend that Russia's economy will be half of what it was over years. So that reveals he's planning to continue this for years. Zelensky, even if he were inclined to negotiate, will not be allowed to do it. And I think there's an intent to force governments to pick sides.
The move comes amid objections by Turkey, a NATO ally, and warnings by Russia. Ankara opposes Finland's and Sweden's accession to the military alliance, citing their longtime support for groups Turkey deems terrorists. Moscow, however, has warned of retaliation if Finland, a country that shares a 1,340-kilometer-long border with Russia, joins NATO. Russia's deputy UN representative, Dmitry Polyansky, went so far as to say that the two nations could turn into potential targets for Russia if they become NATO members. Finland and Sweden say they decided to join the NATO and reverse decades of military non-alignment after Russia attacked Ukraine. But Russia considers NATO's eastward expansion a threat to its national security. The issue was a critical reason Russian officials say pushed Moscow to launch its military operation in Ukraine in February.
Russia had demanded security guarantees from the West before the war began on February 24. Had the U.S. and Europe granted that, the conflict could have been totally averted. But instead, the West responded with more pressure on Kremlin, and now it has practically turned Ukraine into a battleground for a proxy war with Russia. How can the situation therefore be diffused, if at all?
As the war between Ukraine and Russia entered its fourth month, the U.S. Senate passed a $40 billion bill to provide assistance to Ukraine. 86 senators voted for the bill, while 11 others, all Republicans, voted against it, citing its high price tag and the fact that it might not be offset. The bill earmarks $6 billion for arms to be purchased from contractors and sent to Ukraine. It also increases the presidential drawdown capacity from the $5 billion the Biden administration had originally requested to $11 billion. The drawdown capacity allows the president to send away arms and military equipment directly from U.S. stocks at times of emergency.
It used to be the case when you had votes for sanctions against Russia, it would only be two senators voting against. So I think the revolt against this policy is growing. And I can tell you from the campaigning I've been doing and speaking with hundreds of American voters, Americans do not want this war. They don't support spending all this money on weapons. They may not have a completely elevated view of it, but they're inclination is to say, we are suffering here. We're paying $1 million a gallon for gasoline. We're running out of baby formula. Why are we doing this? And I want that to be known around the world that the American people are not represented by the policies of this administration.
The war and the subsequent sanctions on Russia have sent shockwaves across the globe, threatening the most vulnerable economies in the world that have yet to recover from the economic fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's also creating a new global crisis, food shortages.
This is not just about Ukraine. This is about the poorest of the poor around the world who are on the brink of starvation as we speak.
The whole world, including the U.S. and its allies, is paying the price for the war and its ensuing events. The situation would only get worse if the conflict continues indefinitely. The economic, political, and military pressures against Moscow don't seem to contribute to any compromise from the Russian side. The U.S. has expressed its opposition to a prolonged war, but actions speak louder than words.
As a correspondent, Johnny Miller reports from Mariupol, which is now under Russian control, Russian forces are moving out of the town and heading for the heart of the conflict zone in Luhansk, Donbass region.
I'm currently just outside Mariupol, where the last of the Ukrainian soldiers in the Azov battalion are finally surrendering. It's a great victory for the Russians to take Mariupol, but the Ukrainians are also saying that it's a victory for them. Why? Because those fighters at Azovstal were able to hold off or take up time in the Russian army. The Russian army had to surround that steel plant for a long time, stopping Russian soldiers moving elsewhere in the war. And in part, that's correct. When we were coming up this road this morning from Donetsk, we had to wait by the side of a country road for about half an hour as an entire Russian battle group moved past us. Dozens of tanks, dozens of supply trucks, all leaving Mariupol now and heading to where the fighting is in Donbass and Luhansk. Right now, there, the Russian army is trying to encircle the bulk of the Ukrainian army. They're having success using artillery. Even Zelensky, who normally downplays Russian successes, has said today that it is, in his words, hell in Donbass as the Russians use artillery. Many of the Ukrainian soldiers in their trenches are dying without even being able to see the Russian army. This road here, we're heading back to Donetsk now. There's a straight road and there's a safe road. Because on the straight road, there is only about 4 kilometers away at one part is a village held by the Ukrainian army, and they often shell cars coming along. A reminder, the Ukrainians still hold huge parts of Donbass. But the Battle of Mariupol is over. The battle for Donbass and Luhansk is going to accelerate in the next few days.
U.S. President Joe Biden visits South Korea and Japan this week to strengthen alliances and to send a message to China. In Seoul for a summit with new conservative South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol, Biden emphasized the U.S. alliance commitment to the defense of South Korea. Still, some worry about North Korea's response to the hard line being charted by the U.S. and its regional partners. Frank Smith has more from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
U.S. President Joe Biden met South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol for summit talks in Seoul Saturday. The conservative Yoon seeks to strengthen the U.S.-South Korea alliance. Biden's remarks perhaps fell short of the strategic nuclear umbrella the hawkish Yoon seeks, while offering some reassurance regarding North Korea's missile and nuclear programs.
Today, President Yoon and I committed to strengthening our close engagement and work together to take on challenges of regional security, including addressing the threat posed by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, by further strengthening our deterrence posture and working toward a complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
Several demonstrations took place throughout the day outside the summit venue. Peace activists worry Yoon's hasty actions to embrace Washington endanger regional peace and security.
Strengthening the U.S.-South Korea alliance will likely cause a backlash from North Korea, China, and Russia, and destabilize the security of South Korea. If we jump on the U.S. strategy too easily, will this really protect the economy and security of South Korea?
Presidents Yoon and Biden also toured a Samsung Electronics factory. Biden plans to launch the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework in Tokyo next week as the U.S. implements the new trade grouping largely aimed at containing China. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol is just 10 days into his five-year term in office. Through this summit with U.S. President Joe Biden, Seoul has now strongly pivoted to a more pro-American foreign policy. The question then is how U.S. adversaries in the region, China and North Korea, will react. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Australia's Conservative Prime Minister has conceded defeat in national elections as vote counting gets underway.
It's a difficult night for Liberals and Nationals around the country, as nights like this always are. They are humbling, but so is victory. Victory is also humbling and always should be. Tonight, I've spoken to the Leader of the Opposition and the incoming Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, and I've congratulated him on his election victory this evening.
Scott Morrison says even though vote counting is incomplete, the opposition Labour Party looks likely to form a government. He added that he would stand down as the leader of the Liberal National Coalition Party. Early results show the Labour Party has 72 seats and needs 76 seats of the 151-seat House to form a government. The defeat ends nearly a decade of Conservative rule in the government. Inflation and climate change were major voter concerns during this election. Australia's inflation has surged to its highest in over two decades. That is higher than the current wage growth, leaving many people concerned about rising living costs. Palestinians in the occupied West Bank have held a funeral for a 17-year-old killed by Israeli forces. Mourners condemned Tel Aviv for its crimes. The victim, identified as Amjad Al-Fayed, was shot dead during a raid on Jenin refugee camp. Another Palestinian teenager was also critically wounded. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh condemned Fayed's killing, stressing that the international community should hold Israel accountable for its acts. The incident came days after the Israeli military killed Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akhla while she was covering a regime raid on the refugee camp. In recent months, Jenin has been at the center of tensions in the occupied territories. A correspondent to Mona Kandil says Israeli forces keep attacking the Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank, retaliation for Palestinians' anti-Israeli operations.
Israeli forces continue to raid Jenin refugee camp and the city because we have to remind our viewers that a number of Palestinians from Jenin carried out anti-Israel operations and left Israeli settlers dead and wounded in the last few months. And this, of course, had angered the Israeli military and the Israeli street as well. So in order to silence the Israeli settlers, and the demands by the Israelis to change the Israeli cabinet, the Israeli forces continue to raid Jenin and its refugee camp almost on a daily basis, storming Palestinians' homes, arresting people, shooting at Palestinians and Palestinian youths.
The British Home Secretary Priti Patel has branded the anti-Israel boycott, divestment and sanctions movement racist and anti-Semitic. Comments were made during a recent speech at a pro-Israel lobby group meeting where she additionally reaffirmed her loyalty in defending Israel. Rob Carter has more.
Outrage has spread across the pro-Palestine community this week after British Home Secretary Priti Patel branded the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement racist and anti-Semitic. The controversial comments were issued on Monday at a Conservative Friends of Israel lobby group event.
The BDS movement, everything we have seen around the BDS movement is racist. The anti-Semitic troops, the cartoons, the chants.
Founded in 2005, the BDS movement is a Palestinian-led campaign promoting boycott and economic sanctions against Israel. After a notable rise in popularity and success in recent years, the British establishment has acted to essentially criminalise the practice. In response to Patel's comments, onlookers have pointed out her own policies and praise of Israel's ambassador as blatant hypocrisy.
The hypocrisy of Priti Patel calling anyone or anything racist on one hand, whilst openly gushing for Tzipi Hotovli on the other. I mean, Tzipi is an out-and-out anti-Arab racist. She thinks that Jews and Arabs should have no relationships at all. She also thinks that the Nakba, the expulsion of 700,000 Palestinians at the birth of Israel, she thinks that was a myth. Secondly, Priti Patel herself, her comments against Black Lives Matter, against English footballers who took the knee against in solidarity against racism, and also the laws that she's brought into place, like the Nationality and Borders Act, these comments, these laws, they've further, deeper structuralised racism into British society.
In addition to the anti-BDS remarks, Patel laid bare her so-called unflinching support to Israel. This comes just days after the shock killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akhila by Israeli regime forces, making it appear that no matter what crimes are being committed, Tel Aviv can rely on unwavering support from the British Home Office. Robert Carter, London.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Britain, a charitable organisation, Action for Children, says levels of severe and persistent hardship in cost of living crisis are among the worst that it has ever seen. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Patrick Butler. The piece is titled, Poor Families Skipping Meals and Unable to Afford Heating, Charity says.
Thank you.
In Britain, hard-up families are skipping meals, wearing coats indoors to stay warm, and living in the dark because they can't afford to switch on the lights, according to a leading children's charity. Action for Children said in one case, a boy it worked with had been off school with sore feet caused by chilblains. The boy told charity workers that the house was cold all the time because the heating was not on, and that he and his siblings were wearing coats inside and sharing beds at night to keep warm. In another case, a parent told charity workers that she would take care of her toddler to bed with their tea when they got back from nursery, just to keep warm. Other clients described being unable to afford school uniforms, or struggling to afford food, or trying to heat a room with a single gas hub. Current levels of severe and persistent hardship among British families supported by the charity's Children's Centre, triggered by cuts to universal credit and rising energy bills, were among the worst that it could remember, said Action for Children's Director of Policy, Imran Hussain. The worst pain and misery of the cost of living crisis is being felt by children in low-income families. Yet the government is refusing to target help for these children or accept that it needs to rethink its huge cut to universal credit, he said. Ministers have refused to commit to extra direct help for families despite an average annual £700 rise in household fuel costs since April, and also rising food insecurity. Families faced the fastest fall in living standards this year since the 1950s, according to the Office for Budget Responsibility. Children's Hardship Fund set up by the charity Action for Children 2 years ago to provide one-off help to struggling families during the pandemic has evolved into a permanent crisis fund, helping thousands of families, it said. Since October, it has helped almost 2,500 families with grants of about £250 each, half of which were spent on food. Leanne, a mother of two and finance officer from the West Country, said she had needed food vouchers from the Action for Children Crisis Fund because she could not keep up with rising food prices and energy costs. It was a struggle anyway, but things are now so much worse. A lot of people think that food banks are just for people who don't work, but people who work like me need them as well, she said. Analysis of the Crisis Fund showed that half of families accessing it for help reported stress, anxiety, or mental health concerns among the adults or children. One in five applications highlighted the £20 cut in universal credit last October as a trigger for the family's difficulties. Iceland Foods Charitable Foundation, which has donated £300,000 to the fund since November, said that while it was thrilled to help there were limits to its philanthropic work. The charity said government especially had a key role to play in offering a lifeline to families in crisis. Paul Dhaliwal, the trading director of Iceland Foods and a trustee of the foundation, said, "We know that lots of our customers are facing real hardship. Many were badly impacted by the pandemic, and the soaring cost of living crisis has only added to their difficulties." A British government spokesperson said, "We recognise the pressures on the cost of living, and we're doing what we can to help, including spending £22 billion across the next financial year to support people with energy bills and cut fuel duty. For the hardest hit families, we're putting an average of £1,000 more per year into the pockets of working families on universal credit. We've also boosted the minimum wage by more than £1,000 a year for full-time workers, and our household support fund is there to help with the cost of everyday essentials."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
A Kenyan court has ruled that British troops must face charges that, while high on cocaine, they started a fire that destroyed over 12,000 acres of a Kenyan wildlife reserve. Now, the crime took place at Loldiger Hills Ranch, a wildlife reserve used by the British Army Training Unit in Kenya. Lawyer Kelvin Kubai, appearing for the Loldiger community, speaks here after the verdict.
The upshot of the matter is that our court has jurisdiction to pursue the matter occurring as a result of the British Army fire that occurred in Loldiger about an year ago.
Hello, this is Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Now, this week we are focusing on a landmark ruling by a Kenyan court that British troops training in Kenya have no immunity for crimes committed while in the country. But even after this ruling, reports emerge that British troops training in this East African nation have used hazardous white phosphorus. When will this impunity come to an end? Now, the second part of our program will be on plans by the European Union to step up cooperation with African countries to help replace imports of Russian natural gas. We're asking, are African countries ready to be Europe's main source of gas? Our experts will give us their incisive analysis on today's topics, so join us till the end of our show.
UK troops lose immunity in Kenya. An environmental and land court in Kenya recently ruled that the country's courts have jurisdiction to hear and determine criminal and civil matters involving British troops. Following the ruling, British troops involved in deliberately burning down 12,000 acres last year have lost their right to diplomatic immunity against lawsuits in Kenya.
Maxwell Gishuhi, a lawyer for the African Centre for Corrective and Preventive Action, which was part of the legal action against the British Army Training Unit in Kenya, believes the ruling will have impact across the world.
What the court has done, and we must applaud it, is that the court has set a precedent which is groundbreaking, not only in Kenya, not only in Africa, but globally. As you may know, the British forces operate in various parts of the world. And this is a judgment that will be used across the globe, wherever they operate.
Well, for more on the implication of these court ruling against British troops committing crimes in Kenya, we contacted Jonathan Ofei, and sir, a journalist and a commentator on African affairs. Thanks, sir, for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Now, how will this court verdict impact on the presence of British troops in Kenya?
I mean, for quite a long time, and most of these British soldiers on training in Kenya, I mean, I have disregarded or have acted with impunity in Kenya. There have been so many previous cases where they flouted the laws and acted with impunity. But Kenyans, you know, have realized this and are taking measures, you know, to stop this, you know, action with impunity in their country. So I do expect the latest problem to be resolved, to be adequately tackled by the Kenyan authorities.
A Kenyan man was crushed to death by a vehicle as local people rushed to help put out the fire started by the British troops in Loldaiga Conservancy. The community around the conservancy also continues to suffer, as their lawyer explains here.
We still have cases of human-animal conflict. They're still losing their crops. They've now lost 3 seasons. They cannot be able to harvest. So we've lost millions and millions of money, while local businesses in town gain just a few coins from the interactions and profit.
The British Army Training Unit, Kenya, denied the charges brought against it and claimed the troops were protected from prosecution by diplomatic immunity. Why was Britain's Ministry of Defence attempting to have the case dismissed on the basis that the British Army had diplomatic immunity when it was clear these troops committed a crime?
And that's, you know, it indicates, you know, sometimes the double standards of many Western nations, including Britain, when it comes to Africa. Because the British Army waived diplomatic immunity for their operations, training operations in Kenya, a long time ago. So for them, you know, to sort of invoke that diplomatic immunity again also points to the impunity and also the disregard, you know, for the laws, you know, of Kenya, for the laws of the ruling country. So look, Britain, you know, would like any other, like I said, like many other, typical of many other Western countries, will try to adopt any means to avoid or to escape culpability for their misdeeds, you know, in Africa, Kenya in particular. But I'm not sure they are going to succeed this time.
Weeks after the Kenyan court ruled that British troops are not immune from crimes committed in the country, another scandal emerged. James Heppey, the Parliamentary Undersecretary of State for the Armed Forces, admitted that British troops used dangerous white phosphorus mortar rounds during training in Kenya. British MP Kenny McCaskill, who uncovered the use of white phosphorus in Kenya by the Army, said the dangers of the chemical are well documented and have caused injury and misery in many conflicts. Now, how serious is the use of these hazardous, dangerous white phosphorus chemical, and how has it impacted the locals?
Yes, again, this again also shows, you know, it's an indication of the scant regard the West, Britain included, have for Africa. I mean, we have so many cases of toxic goods being dumped in Africa. And these are the case in point, because the British know how harmful, you know, these phosphorus weapons can be. Okay, I mean, the British Army withdrew it from service way back in 2019 after discovering that it contained a poisonous explosive chemical called tetryl. Okay, this tetryl, you know, affects the nervous, the respiratory, and the digestive system. And so Britain, the British Army stopped its use, you know, in 2019. The U.S. stopped its manufacture in way back in 1973, and the Pentagon, you know, has started destroying any stockpiles of the phosphorus. So why keep on using it for training in Africa, in Kenya. Look, there are two instances where one 13-year-old boy suffered lacerations when he came across, he touched, you know, an explosive containing that phosphorus. And another 13-year-old boy lost his eye and two limbs after coming in contact with that explosive. So why should Kenya keep, should Britain keep on using this poisonous, you know, chemical weapon in Kenya? It's a question that, or it's a matter that the Kenya authorities need to tackle and tackle vigorously.
History shows that British forces have been violating human rights and flouting military pacts signed with Kenya. A young Kenyan lady was murdered and her body thrown in a septic tank by a British soldier in 2012. The murder of Agnes Wanjiru adds to the long list of atrocities committed by troops in Kenya. Nidaritu Murithi, the governor of Laikipia County in Kenya, where the crime took place, says troops involved in crimes must be prosecuted, even if that will put in jeopardy a defense pact between London and Nairobi.
Now, you have raised the question that all prosecuting soldiers here would threaten the defense pact between Kenya and the UK. So be it! No defense pact can give foreign soldiers license to kill our citizens.
It is now 10 years since a young Kenyan woman, Agnes Wanjiru, was murdered by a British soldier in Kenya. Can we expect justice in this case?
Yes, we should expect justice because the family of that Kenya woman, you know, in question, you know, has instructed a British law firm, Lay and Day. I mean, Lay and Day, you know, has represented, you know, a group of Kenyans in the past and won in the British courts. So the case, they've taken up the case for that woman called Wanjiru or something, yeah, for that woman in the British court. So we expect, you know, to get justice for that poor woman.
Amnesty International and Impact say that at least 650 women had been raped by British troops between 1965 and 2001, and that there was a conspiracy of silence on these crimes. Now, human rights organizations say there is a deliberate and shocking attempt to obstruct justice for Kenyan victims of UK military abuses. Now, what's your take on this?
The UK authorities cannot, you know, obstruct or cannot escape justice because I know that Kenya has a long history, I mean, of tackling or fighting abuses by the British authorities. I mean, even historical abuses. There was one case recently where the descendants of and even some survivors of the British atrocities committed against the Mau Mau in the pre-independence days were brought to court and they won. Okay, and I know that Kenya will not rest until they receive justice for all the atrocities, all the wrongdoings perpetrated or committed by the British troops in the country. So I'm very confident of a very just outcome, you know, for the Kenyans.
All thanks to Jonathan Ofei Ansah for his insight. Indeed, there are high expectations that Britain's crimes and impunity in Kenya will end as the country's judiciary asserts the sovereignty of this East African nation. We now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall discuss plans by the European Union to import more gas from Africa amid the crisis in Ukraine. Stay with us.
Can Africa replace Russia's gas in Europe?
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa. the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Amid the ongoing conflict between Russia and Ukraine, the European Union is reportedly planning to boost energy cooperation with African countries. Now, this is expected to replace Russian natural gas imports and reduce dependence on Moscow by almost two-thirds this year.
According to projection, Africa's LNG production is forecast at 73 billion cubic meters in 2022. A draft EU document says countries in Africa, in particular Nigeria, Senegal, and Angola, offer largely untapped potential for liquefied natural gas.
Italy has already taken the first step by signing an agreement with Angola last month to increase gas supplies from the southern African country. Tete Antonio, the Angolan Minister of External Relations, speaks here after the gas agreement with Italy.
This is the first step of many, because we have a diversified cooperation with Italy. I think everything is in place for strong cooperation, and especially a strategic partnership.
Now, for more on plans by Europe to import more gas from Africa, we contacted Paolo Raffone, the Secretary General of CIPI Foundation. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
No problem. My pleasure.
Now, our first question to you, sir. Can Africa replace Russia's gas exports to Europe?
Well, this is a theoretical question, because in fact there is the possibility to use some of the gas reserves in certain African countries like Mozambique or Nigeria or even Congo. But the real problem is the extraction and the logistics to transport it to Europe. So it is a very, I would say, medium-term target that, yes, can be made technically, but it will take time and a huge investment of funds to make it feasible.
Most African countries lack infrastructure in the gas sector and have to rely on Western multinationals. If these challenges are not addressed, Africa will not reap the benefits of its vast gas reserves. An official of the Abuja Chamber of Commerce and Industry speaks here on the challenges facing the gas sector.
Oh, you all know that gas is cheap, gas is clean, and gas is green. So why are we not utilizing our gas resources in Nigeria effectively? That's the concern, and that's the narrative we want to bring to the fore. The biggest challenge is infrastructure. Infrastructure is the biggest challenge, and the government should allow private sector partner with them to enable them build infrastructure in Nigeria too, so that the average Nigerian can have access to gas resources. That's the biggest challenge that we have.
What can African countries do to avoid exploitation by Western oil and gas multinationals?
Well, because of the huge investments necessary in the African countries to operationalize the extraction and the treatment of gas for its transportation, it's evident that this is a sort of a new colonial kind of intervention. And I have serious doubts that the African countries would like to go back in history with the Europeans heavily involved into the situation at domestic level to have the gas extracted. So I think it will create a lot of reactions among the population, and even certain governments would not be so keen to participate in this endeavor.
A major concern regarding Africa replacing Russia's gas in Europe is the financial aspect. Nigeria's Minister of State for Petroleum Resources, Timipra Silva, says his country is ready to offer its services as an alternative gas supplier to Europe. In a meeting with European Union diplomats in Abuja, he urged the EU to increase investments in gas and hydrocarbons in Nigeria to be able to meet the bloc's energy needs.
We should please work together towards the future as partners, and that Nigeria will be very willing, and we are very well positioned to be a reliable partner, reliable supplier of energy to Europe.
Now, how can African countries finance the continent's gas project to avoid unfair preconditions imposed by European countries?
There is no way that African countries by themselves can finance the needed investments to have the gas produced and stocked and then transported. So the possibility is only to get loans that can be given by European financial institutions or the IMF, World Bank, and so on. But again, it will take time, and the conditions attached to those loans may be very unfavorable for the African countries. So I see it a remote possibility. Also, the mood of these countries is not so keen to join the Western-led war with Russia. So we have seen it in the United Nations Assembly vote and in other occasions. I would say that also should be seen that the only two African countries which have been brought to Ramstein by the Americans in their meeting against Russia, are only two, Kenya and Liberia. So this shows that the continent, made out of 53 countries, is not so keen to follow the Americans. Even Morocco, that was present in Ramstein, was brought there reluctantly. So I really see it as an idea that can work, but in a completely different setup from today and in the medium long term.
Last year, Nigeria's President Buhari announced the Decade of Gas, an initiative designed to ensure the people of this country benefit from this natural resource.
Gas has enormous potential to diversify and uplift Nigeria's economy, given the country's potential of about 600 trillion cubic feet of gas and the rising global demand for cleaner energy sources has offered Nigeria an opportunity to exploit gas resources for the good of the country. We intend to seize this opportunity. Nigeria LNG contributes about 1% to GDP and has contributed $114 billion in revenues over the years.
How can African countries supply gas to Europe, yet barely meet their domestic needs?
I think that the sovereignty on the natural resources should be the objective of all African states. Already they are being exploited by other kinds of mineral extractions. Let's think Congo, but even Nigeria. And we see all the problems that are linked to these activities financed and operated by Western multinationals. I think that the Africans this time will not abide to a new neocolonial style action by Europeans just because they need suddenly their gas and therefore accept any condition. It will be a lengthy negotiation.
Western powers seeking to isolate Russia over Ukraine are disappointed at what they see as lukewarm support from African nations at the UN General Assembly. As our guest mentioned earlier, most African countries are not aligned with Western policies and stances on the Ukraine conflict. Now, how will this impact on the continent's move to displace Russia's gas in Europe?
I believe so. Yes, the Africans are much more self-confident today in certain countries. Let's take South Africa, which is the most prominent and active on this ground, is much more interested to be part of emerging powers game, so the famous BRICS in conjunction with Russia and China, than to go back to the old colonial relations with Europe. So I do think that politically Africa is quite different from what it was, of course, and will not accept easily to replace the Russian gas at the cost of their state building and reaffirmation of sovereignty that they have gained only a few decades ago. So they will be very wary on accepting any conditions from Europe. And we see also the nervousness in Europe is so high that they are trying to revive the Iranian nuclear deal in order to have another opportunity to get the gas instead of Russia. But the reaction of Iran has been very cold at the moment. They're not rushing into it.
We'd like to thank Paolo Raffone for his insight, and we'll keep our eyes on this subject in our future programs. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. You can send us your comments through our social media handle, and goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.